Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 10.
The fishermen call the gulls flying rats, and the birds were in a feeding frenzy. I wondered if most men reacted that way to Sheila. I walked back to my car and sat on the hood. The fishing boat eased up to the quay and dried off. I watched the two men load the boat onto a trailer and pull it up to the ramp where they rinsed it down. They laughed and horsed around as they stowed gear and loaded coolers into the back of their Suburban. I needed to go fishing for a day. Fresh air, male bonding, maybe a fish to cook up for supper, all away from Whistling Pines, Sheila O'Keefe, and the attempt on her life. It seemed like such a great escape from reality. Too bad a day-long charter would cost half a month's wages. I closed my eyes and thought about the concert. I was on the podium and the band was tuning. I was ready to signal the band to raise their instruments when Sheila emerged stage right, winding her way through the impatient musicians. I remember being shocked by her plunging neckline, the sausage skin tightness, the sequins, and the amount of thigh showing when she sat in the chair. The bassoon was hanging from her neck, and the reed was already in her mouth, clamped between her front teeth. She set three bottles next to her chair, put the reed in the mouthpiece, and tuned. I was so captivated by the scene that I didn't notice the rest of the band reacting to her. It was all about Sheila, just as she wanted it. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 19. I drove back into town past the golf course curling club, an unusual combination anywhere but northern Minnesota, and stopped for groceries. My checkbook knew the month-end pinch of finances, but my cupboard said it was time to refill. I walked the aisles, carefully selecting items dictated by coupons and the newspaper ads sitting by the entrance. Hamburger was on sale and versatile. Instant oatmeal was quick and filling. I didn't use milk fast enough to consume a half gallon before it started evolving into a new life form. Jenny's words about scurvy popped into my head as I walked down the canned vegetable aisle, so I picked up a couple cans of green beans and a can of corn that were 3 for $2. Generic baked beans were inexpensive and filling, sometimes making a meal themselves if Jenny wasn't around. The store brand of bread was on sale, a little doughy, as children prefer, but chock full of calories and with enough chemicals to keep it free of mold for at least a couple weeks. I had a coupon for peanut butter and I splurged on a jar of grape jelly. I checked out and the total left a little black ink in the checkbook, so I declared the trip a success. I drove back to my house with plans to fry a burger, jam it between a couple slices of bread, and pick up my guitar to try a few new songs I'd chosen for the weekly sing-along at Whistling Pines. There's an old saying about the best-laid plans of mice and men, and my plans went out the window when I drove past my neighbor's house. Dolores was sitting on her porch making use of her wicker porch furniture. Because of the short Two Harbors summers, called the poor sledding season by many of the locals, the wicker spent more time covered in snow than warming in the sun. She waved frantically as I drove past, so I pulled into my driveway and set my groceries on my front step before walking to check on Dolores. I expected to be asked to take another picture of her toe to show the doctor the progression of whatever was happening. "Peter, I'm so glad you're here." Dolores pushed herself out of the chair and limped to the top of the steps. Although the temperature was in the 70s, she wore a long dress and a gray sweater. She had an amazing amount of energy. I was always concerned that she'd fall and break a hip during one of her daily outings, but she was like the mail service. Neither sleet nor snow nor dark of night kept her from her appointed rounds. she had to be at the Catholic Church for Sunday Mass and Wednesday Bingo. The Senior Center served roasted chicken for lunch on Tuesdays, and she never missed pasty day on Thursdays. Her Mondays were unstructured, and she frequently chose to bake, and I was often the beneficiary of her baked goods. Some were edible. Today it wasn't about her cooking. "There was a woman here," Dolores said as she limped down from the porch, grasping the railing securely between steps. She knocked on the door and then walked in the house. I thought she looked suspicious, so I walked over to check her out. I had a chilling vision of her confronting someone really threatening. I knew from history that Dolores was fearless, but she wasn't invincible. "Was it someone you knew?" I asked. "No, not at a distance," she said, walking across the uneven grass, using her cane for stability. She came out when I got to the steps, and I recognized her as the bassoon player from the city band. "Sheila was here?" I asked, surprised. "She carried something in," Dolores said, pushing past me. "It was small." She passed the bags of groceries I'd set on my front step and walked into the house. She took a few steps into the house and stopped at the kitchen entrance. "I think it's that flower vase." On the center of the kitchen table was a crystal vase with a single yellow rose. I opened the card leaning against the vase. The inside was blank except for the words, "Thanks for being there when I needed help." "Aren't you still going out with that little blonde?" Dolores asked. "Yes," I replied, not sure what else to say. "That's Sheila. Her tight little pink top didn't leave much to imagination. In my day, a woman didn't flaunt her figure like that. I think it's better to leave a little mystery for a man." I closed the card and folded it in half before tossing it into the kitchen wastebasket. The disposal of the rose was more difficult. It was symbolic of Sheila's misguided attention, so it had to go, but it was pretty. I handed the vase to Dolores. "A pretty flower for a pretty lady," I said. She looked at the flower and appeared troubled. "Roses are pretty, but they just don't hold up very well." "Enjoy it while it lasts." "Have you tried the piccolo yet?" she asked as she retreated to the front door, the rose in one hand and her cane in the other. "I've played some, but I've been a little busy with the city band this week." John Philip Sousa wrote a lovely march that features a piccolo solo. The band always plays it at the finale of the last concert. "Stars and Stripes Forever" is the song. I think it would be a little presumptuous of me to step in as the guest conductor and assign myself a solo, especially since I've only been playing the piccolo for a week. Dolores gave me a dismissive wave and walked to the door. "I would personally like to hear you play the piccolo solo in Stars and Stripes Forever." "Did you play the piccolo solo with the band?" I asked. Dolores stopped on my front step and turned. It was the 4th of July, and VE Day was just behind us. We were all hoping the Japs would surrender before any more boys were killed in the Pacific. I'd been playing flute in the city band for most of the war, and the director asked me if I'd ever played the piccolo. I said I owned a piccolo, but I hadn't played enough to be proficient. He told me to start practicing because he had a special event coming up. A week before the 4th, he gave me the music for Stars and Stripes Forever and told me I was playing the piccolo solo. "I'm sure you were fabulous." I was scared to death. I practiced day and night, and I fumbled my way through it. At that point in time, it didn't matter. The whole country was tired of the war, but still full of patriotism. The crowd gave us a standing ovation. She paused at the door and added, "A little girl named Abby Finch asked me to come back and play a piccolo duet with her during this week's final concert." When I said no, she said she wasn't playing the Stars and Stripes solo alone. I told her I knew someone who could play it with her. That's you. I stared speechless at the door after she limped away. After 15 months in Iraq, we'd been moved to Kuwait, and from there we flew back to Dover Air Force Base in Maryland. When I walked down the ramp from the plane, the Air Force band was playing Stars and Stripes Forever. Tears rolled down my cheeks at the thought of that arrival. For a whole year, I was sure I'd die in Iraq, and the sound of the Air Force band playing Sousa was the first time I really believed I was going to live. It would be a strain to direct Stars and Stripes Forever, much less play a piccolo duet. It wasn't happening, no matter how much it would disappoint Dolores or Abby Finch. I wasn't about to stand in front of the crowd and break into tears if I had a flashback. I unloaded the groceries and folded the bags, then went to my bedroom and took out the piccolo. When I blew into it, the notes were shrill. After a few abortive attempts, I ran through a few scales and managed to crowd my fingers close enough to make clear, distinct notes. I chided myself for not bringing the music home from Whistling Pines, but after digging through a few music books in the piano bench, I found a book of marches and opened it to Stars and Stripes Forever. I played it through once on the piano without falling apart and then attempted the piccolo solo. I bumbled through it a couple of times, then stumbled through it a couple more times before finally producing something that met my personal expectations. I was startled by applause at the living room door. I spun, and Jenny was standing there with a silly grin, slowly clapping. I felt the color rising in my neck. "For someone who claims not to have played the piccolo before, that sounded pretty good," she said. "That sounded very familiar. What song is it?" "Stars and Stripes Forever," I replied, as I put the piccolo back into its tiny case. "Is the band playing that Thursday?" she asked, as she walked into the kitchen with a shopping bag slung on her arm. The end of a French baguette extended beyond the top of the bag. "Apparently it's a tradition to play it as the last song of the year-end concert," I replied. Dolores asked me if I'd played her piccolo yet, and told me she wanted me to play it Thursday. I decided to give it a test drive. It went okay, but you don't put someone on stage playing an unfamiliar instrument based on one semi-successful attempt. "You sounded professional. I think you should consider playing it." I heard water running and pans clattered as she set them on the stovetop. "As guest conductor, I can't just step in and assign myself a song," I said, migrating to the kitchen door. "Why not? Don't you think the band could handle it?" "It's not my place to step in and play during the second concert I've directed." Whistling Sousa, Chapter 20. The aroma of Italian tomato sauce filled the kitchen while Jenny dug through my cupboards. "Don't you own a colander?" she asked, stretching to look into the cupboard above the refrigerator. Noodles were boiling on the stove next to bubbling spaghetti sauce. I reached over her head and pulled the colander from the top shelf of the cupboard. I made a show of blowing the dust from it, which elicited a groan. She took it from me and scrubbed it with soap under hot water. "I'm surprised you're here," I said, as I broke off a piece of the French bread and rubbed it across the stick of butter she'd put on a saucer. "Not that I'm complaining. I like to have you around, but you don't usually show up two nights in a row, not even when invited," I thought. "It's so weird. Dad and Jeremy are bonding, and they told me to find something to do for the night. They caught a steelhead or something last night, and they're going back to see if they can catch some more." The timer rang, and Jenny pulled the boiling noodles off the stove and poured them into the colander. "I don't suppose you have a bottle of Chianti in the wine cellar?" "I have a cellar, but I tend to buy wine one bottle at a time, and the bottles rarely survive an hour." An obvious solution came to mind. "I happen to be out of Chianti, but I do have a couple bottles of Lake Superior Lager that are at their peak. They are equipped with the latest in sealing technology," I said, as I twisted off the caps. I think Chianti is overrated. Jenny brought the pot of sauce to the table and set it on a cast iron trivet shaped like a pear. As she went to the sink for the colander of noodles, she said, "Red wine has fewer calories than beer." As she set the colander on a plate, she added, "I like having dinner with you, but my body isn't accustomed to regular meals with the amount of calories you take in." "I eat salad, sometimes," I said as I piled pasta onto my plate, "and I have vegetables and fruits regularly, sort of." "I heard you solved the mystery of Tinker's injury." "Yeah, I'm a regular Sherlock Holmes. I saw an Amish guy selling rubber band guns and had a blinding flash of the obvious. I broke off another piece of bread and spread butter on it. I wandered back to the scene of the crime, lined up the angle of the shot, and snooped around a little bit. First thing you know, I'm in the stall with the best angle for the shot, and I find a rubber band gun hidden away in a jacket pocket." "So what happened to the shooter?" I told his father the story, and the last I heard, Dad was putting the fear of God into him. I don't think anything else is required. Somewhere outside, I heard the staccato rattle of a woodpecker through the open windows. "I thought you would report it to the sheriff and the kid would end up in juvenile hall or something," she said. The rattle of the woodpecker got closer. The deep, resonant rattle gave me the impression that it was probably a pileated woodpecker, the largest member of the Minnesota woodpecker family. "Is the woodpecker pecking on your house?" "He's a big pileated woodpecker, and if he were pecking on my siding, the house would be resonating." The words were hardly out of my mouth before we heard the first boom. I flew from the chair and had Jenny around the waist as we fell to the floor. "What's going on?" Jenny whispered. "Why are we on the floor?" "Gunshot." I shushed Jenny, and we lay on the floor silently. The woodpecker rattle started again and was followed by a second boom. I launched myself from the floor and ran for the front door. Jenny yelled after me, "What's going on?" "Dolores," I yelled back as I threw the front door open and ran toward my neighbor's house. The backyard was covered in a rolling white fog. I could smell the sulfur and nitrates from burnt black powder. My first fear at hearing the gunshots was that someone was assaulting Dolores. Once I saw the smoke and smelled the black powder, I knew it was Dolores who was assaulting someone or something. She had a collection of valuable firearms locked in a gun cabinet, and I had the key since a springtime incident when she was shooting at a rabbit from her back porch. She'd either found another key or broken the lock because her back porch was once again the scene of a shooting. I paused at the corner of the house and peeked around rather than running headlong into another barrage of gunfire. As I peeked around the corner, I felt Jenny against my side. "What's going on?" she asked. I pulled Jenny with me as we rounded the corner and walked up the steps. High above us, the woodpecker started another series of staccato pecking, assaulting a corner of Dolores's cedar siding. Dolores was standing near her back door, trying to measure black powder from an antique powder horn into a brass cylinder. Because of her tremors, more powder was spilling onto the floor than was going into the measurer. I feared another shot would turn the porch into a conflagration. "Peter," Dolores said, "please measure some powder for me." She seemed totally unsurprised that I'd shown up on her back porch, and she pushed the brass cylinder to me. On a nearby table was a small wooden cask full of lead shot, and alongside the cask was a pile of neatly trimmed cotton pads I assumed she planned to use as wadding to seat and hold the shot charge. A tiny metal tin held an array of brass-colored muzzleloader caps. As unsteady as Dolores was, I found it amazing that she's managed to put two powder and shot charges into the old double-barrel muzzle-loading shotgun that was propped against the railing. I took the powder measurer and powder horn from her and set them on the table. "What are you shooting at?" I asked. Dolores looked at me like I was stupid. "That bird," she replied, pointing at the woodpecker who was trying to find a new spot to peck. "I thought we'd locked up all your guns," Jenny said, nervously eyeing the antique double-barrel shotgun. It had huge old hammers that used a primer cap to ignite the black powder in the barrels. I guessed that it predated the Civil War. "Oh, no, dear," Dolores replied. "The valuable ones are locked up. I've had to keep one around to deal with vermin and such." "I'll take care of the woodpecker," I said. "It looks like he's found a rotten piece of wood. I can climb up and replace it tomorrow after work." I took her elbow and guided her back into the house. "If that doesn't work, I'll get a rubber snake and hang it from your eaves." "A rubber snake?" Jenny asked, following us into Dolores' kitchen. "Birds are afraid of snakes," I said, as I steered Dolores toward a chair. "Really?" Jenny asked. "Yes, everywhere except in Ireland, where St. Patrick chased all the snakes away." "Now I know you're pulling my leg," Jenny said, helping Dolores sit down. "I swear," I said, "the snakes scare the birds away. Now, Dolores, are there any more guns around?" "Oh, no," she replied. "It would be unsafe to have them around where someone might stumble across them. All the others are in the case." "I think it's best if I take the shotgun home and clean it for you. That old black powder is corrosive, and I should get the powder residue out before it pits the bore." "I heard you playing the piccolo duet, Peter," Dolores said in a change of direction that almost left me behind. "It took you a couple of attempts, but you had it down the last time." "I think it is beyond my powers to add myself to the arrangement," I replied, repeating my earlier statement. Dolores gave me a sour look. "There's a little girl depending on you. Keep that in mind." "Jenny," I said, trying to move to a new subject, "please take a look at Dolores's toe. The bingo ladies recommended amputation." Jenny, always the calm and collected nurse, was amazingly unfazed by my out-of-the-blue request and quickly set to unlacing Dolores's orthopedic shoe. She examined the toe through the thick support hose Dolores wore, pinching it and bending it, asking Dolores if any of her actions caused pain, and getting positive responses to each inquiry. "If it's not causing you much pain," Jenny said, as she relaced the shoe, "I think it's bruised, and you should leave it alone." "My foot aches a little less every day," Dolores said, regaining control of the situation, "and those young doctors are just trying to make money by lopping off perfectly good toes." "Well, it's not perfectly good," Jenny said, "but there really isn't any reason to amputate if it's not infected or gangrenous." "It's fine," Dolores said, rising from her chair and taking a few unsteady steps. "See, I hardly limp at all." Back in my kitchen, Jenny rewarmed our plates in the microwave while I stashed the shotgun in the basement with Dolores's .22 rifle, confiscated during the attempted bunny-shooting incident the previous spring. I sat down and took a deep breath before realizing that Jenny was staring at me. "What?" I asked, chewing a mouthful of spaghetti and sauce. "I have bruises," she replied. "Huh? I'm bruised from being thrown to the floor. Couldn't you just say, 'Jenny, I think Dolores is shooting a gun. Let's walk to her house and see what's happening.'" I tipped my head back and took a deep breath. That would be a rational response. I'm still conditioned from Iraq, where a second of delay can mean the difference between being dead or alive. When I hear gunfire, I hit the floor and think about it after I'm down. "You thought about it long enough to throw me down with you." "I'm sorry, but that's how we made sure the new guys lived long enough to develop their instinctive reaction to gunfire," I replied. "You tackle them as you duck for cover. Most of them catch on pretty quickly." "How bad are your bruises?" She lifted her sleeve, and I could see where my fingers had dug into her upper arm when I pulled her off the chair. "I'm sure my hip and left cheek will be colorful tomorrow. You better hope I don't have to go to the doctor for a checkup. They'll have social services knocking on your door before nightfall." "I'm sorry, it's just..." Jenny got up from her chair and pulled my head to her breast. "I know, it's just instinct." She stroked my hair, and I wrapped my arms around her waist. I just wish your instincts were a little less physical. She kissed the top of my head and picked up her plate. I've lost my appetite, she said, before pulling out the wastebasket and scraping the remnants of her spaghetti into the trash. Before putting the wastebasket away, she reached into it and pulled out a white card with spaghetti stains. Peter, what's this thank you note in your garbage? It's from Sheila O'Keefe. I tried to talk to Sheila O'Keefe the night she had the allergic reaction, and she dropped off a thank you note and a flower, which I gave to Dolores. You talked to her here? Jenny asked, tapping the card on the edge of the sink. No, we had lunch at Blackwood's. She gave you a card at lunch, and you brought it home? No, we had lunch, and she stopped by later, I said, suddenly aware of the line of questioning and how it might look like Sheila had stopped off for an afternoon delight. I was grocery shopping. Dolores saw her walk into the house and came over to investigate. Why was she here after lunch? Did she have something to add to her previous testimony? Jenny's voice was getting sharper with every sentence. It wasn't testimony, I replied. I just asked her if anyone had reason to harm her. We talked about it over lunch. Why did she come to your house after lunch? She dropped off a flower and that note, I repeated. I threw the note away and gave the flower to Dolores. I have no interest in Sheila or her flowers. If I'd been home, I would have refused the flower and told her to leave. I've heard rumors about Sheila's business lunches, Jenny said, throwing the card back into the garbage. The rumor is that she's usually the dessert. I got up and hugged Jenny. I have no interest in Sheila other than a professional interest in her musical skills. She's the best and only bassoonist in Two Harbors and possibly the most talented musician in the band. I felt Jenny's muscles relax under my hug. Be careful. Sheila's a cougar and she loves to chase down good-looking younger men like you. After all her years of conquest, I hate to think about what you might catch from her. I'm sure there's nothing a good dose of penicillin wouldn't cure. Jenny pushed back and looked me in the eye. I think amputation would be the cure. I'd be most likely to apply. Ouch. You'd better believe it would hurt. I wouldn't use anesthesia or sharp utensils for the operation. Jenny's blue eyes became suddenly steely. I remembered her comments about the Norwegian pilot who'd fathered Jeremy. She'd talked about him one night after a few beers, and although she hadn't spilled any tears at the time, it was obvious the topic was terribly painful. I pulled her close, now more attuned to the deep pain she'd felt over the lies and deceit she'd suffered with the breakup of that relationship. That pain wasn't far under the surface. You're just as reflexive as I am, I said. Jump at the sound of bullets, and you recoil at the scent of another woman. Do you have nightmares, too? Not nightmares, as much as fits of crying, she said, letting out a deep sigh. You can be free if you don't want to move on. Please just be upfront about it and don't go sneaking around behind my back, hoping I won't notice.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.